Sudan accuses its new neighbor, South Sudan, of supporting rebellions in the north. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Journalists and relief workers who rushed to the site of last month's powerful earthquake in eastern Turkey are among the victims missing in the aftermath of a second earthquake Wednesday. Today, rescue teams are searching the debris of the collapsed Bayram Hotel for two journalists. The death toll has risen to 19 so far. Among the dead, a Japanese relief worker who traveled to the city of Van to help in the recovery from the October 23rd earthquake that killed hundreds of people and displaced thousands more. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections and celebrating National Adoption Month at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, our Veterans Day edition, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs songs in tribute to the men and women who have served in the armed forces. Also, an interview with war correspondent David Wood about soldiers who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan with catastrophic injuries. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. At the controls this hour is Jason Croft. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Before we get going on this morning's archive program for this hour, just one programming note. We had planned to have as our guest on this show in this hour, Governor Jim Edgar, and we were not able to get that worked out, but we're hoping that we can reschedule that program and have him on another day, and we'll certainly let you know. So in place of that, we'll be going to the Focus archive for a program from a little bit earlier this fall. In fact, it's a show that we first broadcast on September 12th. So as you listen to the program, do keep in mind that in this hour, we will not take calls. It began as a single tea shop in New York, and it became the first retailer to sell $1 billion in goods. The Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, better known probably to most as the A&P, forever changed the grocery business, and in the process, it put thousands of mom-and-pop stores out of business. This morning, on Focus, we'll be talking with Mark Levinson. He's the author of a new book. The title of the book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. Hill and Wang is the publisher. And takes a look how the A&P developed a new way for distributing food at very low cost, and eventually how the company was brought down by some of the forces that it helped to create. Our guest, Mark Levinson, is the author of another book, The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger, which was shortlisted for the 2006 Financial Times and Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year Award. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Levinson, hello.
Hi, good morning, David.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. And you know what I think is so fascinating here? First of all, just the story of the A&P is fascinating in and of itself. But also, I think what's so very interesting is that this is a story that feels very contemporary because it deals with two basic and conflicting impulses that we have. On the one hand, to support small independent business, and on the other, to get whatever it is we're trying to buy at the lowest price. And that's just that's a struggle now. That's an issue now. And it was back at the time that the A&P got going.
That's true. That's absolutely correct. There's also a conflict that we still see today between capitalism and competition. And on the one hand, and our desire for stability on the other. If you ask most Americans to describe our economy, they would say we've got a capitalist free market economy, something like that. And people like the idea of capitalism in the sense that they like to be able to own their own businesses. They think it's good that the government doesn't own these businesses and so forth. On the other hand, people are very uncomfortable with competition, with free markets, because free markets mean that companies go out of business, that entrepreneurs' businesses go bust, that people lose their jobs, that communities lose the local tax base. And so we're very uncomfortable with the economic effects of competition. situation. And the A&P story is that in spades, that on the one hand, people really like the advantages of saving money from the efficiency of a chain store. On the other hand, they really disliked its effect on their local community in terms of destroying what they saw as good jobs.
Yeah, and so that's how it is that something as basic as where people go to buy their groceries really became a very contentious political issue, and that's something that really raged in this country for decades.
It really did. From the chain stores first became a political issue in about 1912, and they remained a political issue until after World War II. People have forgotten this now, but we had in many states taxes on chain stores. So a store might have to pay a tax of $5 for the first one in the state, but $500 per store for everyone over 50 stores or something like that, which was a significant part of chain stores' profits to level the playing field in favor of the independent merchant. There were laws that tried to keep manufacturers from giving volume discounts to chain stores. There were laws that said that a chain had to have the same price for every item in every store or was violating the law. If coffee cost less in Urbana than it did in Chicago, that could have been a legal violation, or in some states it could have. There were just a whole host of laws that were introduced, all really designed to protect independent shopkeepers and to hurt the chains.
Yeah, and perhaps maybe more than any other chains, the thing that people, and when I say people, we mean people in politics, were concerned about was the A&P.
Well, the A&P was omnipresent. If you can believe it, the A&P had almost 16,000 stores back in the 1920s. It was in 39 of the then 48 states. This was the chain that people knew of and feared. There were certainly other chains around. They weren't as numerous, and some of the chains that got bigger later did not have as many stores in this period. But A&P was really everywhere. There's a memoir out from a man who later founded another grocery company that proved to be quite famous. But he recalls when he started his little grocery. And the title of the book is the advice he received, which was, don't make A&P mad. A&P was feared because it was so huge and because it was almost everywhere.
Yeah, and that's something that certainly I'm sure a lot of people listening to us will still remember here among colleagues. People talk about, oh, yes, they remember when they were kids, there was an A&P. And then the next question people ask is, and whatever happened to it, does it still exist? And in fact, it does, but much, much, much diminished from what it was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The A&P story is to a certain extent the story of the two brothers who ran it for many years. They controlled all the shares, so it was a privately held company, and they ran it as they wanted with huge success. And then in the 1950s, they both died. And the company was then taken over by people who'd worked for it since the horse and buggy days, who really had a very conservative attitude and didn't lack vision. So the new leaders basically kept on doing what they'd been doing, and starting in the 50s, A&P missed some important social changes. The suburbs were growing like crazy. A&P didn't have many stores in the suburbs. It had most of its stores in town centers and city centers. California was a big growth story after World War II, clear up to 2000, actually. It was the fastest growing state in every decade for the rest of the century. A&P didn't have very many stores in California, and its managers didn't want to build more stores in California because they thought it was too far away. So it fell out of being in tune with the social trends, and by the early 1960s, it was already in a downward spiral. It was eventually sold and was run into the ground further. At this point, it's actually operating in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It's a regional supermarket retailer in and around New York.
Our guest in this hour is Mark Levinson, and we're talking about his book, The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America, published by Hill and Wang. And it is a history of the grocery store chain, A&P, and how it rose and how it fell. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back here to the beginning and talk a little bit about George Gilman, this man who opened the tea shop in New York, the tea business in New York. And this was a guy who had previously been in the leather-making business. He was a tanner. So what was it that led him to want to get involved with coffee and tea?
Well, I'm only guessing. Back in those days, there was a whole area of lower Manhattan, which was known as the Swamp. And it was a leather-making area. We're talking now about just before the Civil War. For those who know New York, this area is now mostly covered by the approach roads to the Brooklyn Bridge. Back in the day, it had a lot of little narrow streets and alleyways and three- and four-story buildings where people made leather and stored leather, and that was Gilman's business. And I suspect that he wanted to move into a somewhat more prestigious line of work and one that maybe wasn't quite as smelly as dealing with leather. So he started carrying tea, which he would have purchased at the docks the same way he purchased his hides. And founded a tea store, eventually gave the leather business to his brother. And so he started building this tea store, which was quite unremarkable so far as we know. The first we really know about A&P is in 1863. It was called at that time the Great American Tea Company. And the reason it came to public attention is because it started running newspaper ads around the country saying, we will sell tea at 2 cents per pound. It listed the price of tea in the ads, and it told people to mail their orders to New York City. This was a pretty novel idea in 1863. And pretty soon they came up with the idea of a buying club. You folks in your town, if you get all your orders together and mail them in at once, it'll be cheaper, you'll save money. And the ads contained instructions on how to order by mail because people were not familiar with this new idea. So the Great American Tea Company in the 1860s became a fairly sizable enterprise with national scope. Hmm. And Gilman was the genius behind this. Gilman was a marketer, and he tended to have outrageous marketing stunts and get public attention, and that's what would have people buying their tea from Great American Tea Company. Hmm. A&P came out of that. We had the Transcontinental Railroad. After the Civil War, that linked the Atlantic and the Pacific, and so he started a new operation. He called it the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and he didn't tell anybody that it was related to Great American, so you could order your tea from either one. He pretended that they were competing businesses. They used different addresses, even though each address was just a different entrance to a building that was on the corner. Hmm. But he thought that would stimulate business to have these two companies seeming to be competitors.
It seems that there was one big idea that runs all the way through from the beginnings to the golden age, and that allowed the company to really grow and prosper. And the one simple idea was that if you could deal in enough volume, that means that you could offer low price, and if you offered low price and you got enough people in the door to buy the product, then that circle would continue to go. So the idea was volume, volume, volume. If you could do enough volume, you could keep your prices low, and if you had low prices, people would favor you over the competition. And it seems that was the basic idea all along.
That's exactly right. Remember, we're talking about a time when they didn't have the kind of accounting concepts we have today. So people didn't tend to think about a return on investment in their store, for example. What they knew was that they had purchased this product at wholesale for X, and they're selling it at retail for Y. And so they've got a margin there of 1 cent or 2 cents. And that was their profit. And they wanted to have that profit as wide as possible. And A&P's consistent philosophy through its history up until the 1950s was that that's not the right idea, that what you need to be doing is maximizing volume, and when you do that, you can maximize your return on investment, and you shouldn't worry so much about the widest possible margin. In fact, if your margin is too wide, that's a bad thing, not a good thing, because it means you're probably driving customers away.
And that seems that's on the face of it, that seems like a very simple idea, and yet nobody had done it before.
No, the A&P over its history did a lot of things that nobody had done before.
Hmm.
One of those came in 1912, for example. This was a time when there was a lot of concern nationally about food prices, a lot of talk about the inefficiency of the food industry. There was also a lot of work going on in the manufacturing sector at that point about scientific management. How do we have more efficiency and so forth? But one of the two brothers who controlled the A&P at that point, John Hartford, took these ideas about scientific thinking and tried to apply them to the grocery business. He's opened a new store with no advertising. The store had a limited selection of products that he thought would sell well. It had one employee, the store manager, who locked the door when he went to lunch. It did not offer credit. It did not offer trading stamps. All it offered was low prices. And that experiment showed two things. One is that the store's sales were lower than those of other stores because it didn't have as many products and it wasn't open as long and so forth. But number two, the store's profits were higher than those of the other stores. So John Hartford showed that with proper management, you could actually extract more profit by lowering your costs and lowering your prices.
Mm-hmm.
This store, which he called the A&P Economy Store, was a hit. And after the first one of these was opened in 1912, A&P started opening them by the hundreds and then by the thousands until by 1920, A&P had close to 5,000 stores. And that's the point at which it became the largest retailer in the world.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller here. I'd like to join in the conversation. Anybody is welcome to do that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Ivesdale, line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, hi.
Hey, I just really had a comment. I remember when I was a child, I was living in Champaign at the time, and there was an A&P store down there near John and Neal Street. And anyway, I don't know if it was a particular store owner or the people that worked there or what, but that was the most friendly store to go into. And as far as that, it just seemed like the neighborly hometown store. And when some of the competition grocery stores started opening up, they were just seemed so businesslike and so formal, and you're nothing but a number. I mean, we continued to shop at A&P until they eventually closed. That's all I had. I just thought that my experience with the A&P store that I had was a very positive, friendly one. And it's actually one of my fond childhood memories.
that's interesting to hear. The brothers that controlled it, John and George Hartford, spent a lot of time on managers. They spent time training managers. They had a lot of advice for managers about how to run their stores. They had manuals and rules. And so people were not free agents. They were heavily directed. On the other hand, people who did well were very well rewarded. So they sent secret shoppers into the stores to make sure that you, the store manager, were following the rules. Did you do your window displays the way that you were instructed to do your window displays? Was the store nicely, was it clean? Was the floor swept? Was the merchandise neatly arranged on the shelves? Did you greet the guests, the shoppers, when they came in the store? And the storekeepers who did that well would receive special recognition and bonuses every year. So
I certainly hope
devoted a lot of attention to this.
I was just going to say, I certainly hope the store manager there in Champaign was rewarded highly, because he he sure had a friendly business there, I thought. So, well, I'll hang up and listen to the rest of the program.
Okay, well, thanks for the story.
Thank you.
So, well, was customer relations something that they put a lot of emphasis on?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. There's a wonderful document that John and George Hartford's father was the one. His name's George H. Hartford, and he actually took the company over from Gilman and ran it for about 30, 40 years with his sons gradually coming into the business. And George H. Hartford had put out this advice manual for store managers in the early 1900s, which is really very sound. It says, do not try to persuade the shopper to buy things she's not inclined to buy. This is an age of cleanliness. Don't touch the merchandise with your bare hand. Things like that that store managers were meant to learn and to remember. When he was alive, George H. was in the store every day. He actually died. He'd been in a store the day he died. John, one of his two sons, was in stores frequently, so they were out there trying to talk to customers, talk to store managers. They attached a great deal of value to it, and they were very they were very paternalistic. This was a family-controlled company. They expected their people to work hard, but they also guaranteed them rewards. Okay, they felt that if someone had given several years to the A&P had an obligation to that person, and so they were going to treat their employees well.
That it's just remarkable. It's one of those cases of a business that was very closely held and run by a family for a very long time. And as you explained, it moved from George Gilman to George Hartford, and then his sons George Jr. and John took over. And these two guys spent all of their working lives, essentially, I assume, all of their adult lives, working in the company. They never went to college. They didn't even finish high school. This company was their entire life.
It absolutely was. And these two brothers complemented each other in very unique ways. The older brother, George L., was a very reclusive sort. He was good at math. He won a prize in algebra back when he was in high school. He was comfortable with figures. He wasn't very comfortable with people. So even though he became one of the wealthiest people in the United States and was the president of one of the biggest corporations in the United States, he was almost never seen in public. He didn't give speeches. He didn't make social appearances. He rarely met with employees. His idea of a good time was going home and doing a jigsaw puzzle. Okay, the other brother, John Hartford, was very outgoing, very gregarious. He loved to meet people. And so John was the company's public face. John would go and meet with managers. John would go and meet with suppliers. John would go and give the speeches, do whatever needed to be done. And so John was the visionary. He was the one who forced A&P again and again to change strategy because social trends were changing and the business was changing. And John kept telling people, we got to change. And George was the one who would say, but we got to do this profitably. We got to do this profitably. So it's a nice compliment. You know, you've heard of a lot of people in business who were visionary and who drove their companies into the ground because they were so visionary they forgot that they needed to make a profit. And in this case, this tandem worked really well because John could be visionary and George could be sure that John's visions were implemented in a way that kept the company profitable.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, line 4, right here. Hello.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. So this might get a little bit outside the scope of the guest expertise, but I was just curious because my question was also going to ask about the role of public relations of one-on-one interaction, customer service, importance to the success of the store. So I'm wondering, how did we go from a chain that, as you just mentioned, was very customer service centric to sort of the monolithic, can't find anybody who works there type stores like, your Target or your Walmart. How did that process play out? I don't know if that's something you can answer, but that's what's rattling around my head right now.
Okay. Well, starting in the 1930s, there was this new kind of business which came to be known as a supermarket. You got to understand that up until the 30s, your average grocery store probably had about 3 employees. This was a small business. And these supermarkets came along. They were quite small by today's standards, but they were several times the size of one of these little grocery stores. And so for the first time, really as these stores became more common, you started to have a distinction in the store between managers and employees. Okay. Up until then, yes, every store had a manager, but the manager basically did the same work as the employees. They were all loading and unloading things. They were all dealing with customers. They were all sweeping the floor. Now you had a different sort of situation just because you had a bigger store, and the bigger store really came about in response to customer tastes. For example, up until the 1920s, customers typically bought meat in a different place. You had a butcher store, and a butcher store was separate from a grocery store. A&P introduced the idea of what they called a combination store, which had a meat counter in it along with groceries. And then you started to have the chains bring produce into their stores in the 1930s. They hadn't done that before, so the stores became bigger. And now you started to have a whole different set of problems in terms of morale, in terms of employee relations. The store managers back in the 20s and the 30s, the store managers were all union people too. They not so much at A&P, which wasn't unionized until late, but in smaller stores, the store managers were right alongside the workers. And as the stores got bigger, that sort of thing really went away. So a lot of this is really in response to customer demand, what people were willing to pay for. As people had refrigerators in their households, they wanted to buy more each time they shopped. As people had cars, they could afford, they were able to go farther to buy more goods each time they shopped. So instead of walking to your neighborhood grocery store every day, as was common in the 1920s, by the 1930s, people could drive to a store that was bigger and a little farther away but had better prices. And that was really the beginning of this trend. Now, interestingly, we've gotten to this point where there's been a bit of a reversal. The average supermarket got bigger and bigger and bigger for many years. And the last couple of years, they've started getting smaller again because consumers have said, this is too much trouble. You know, I need a bottle of milk, and why do I need to go through a 50,000 square foot store or you know, a super center just to get one or two items? It's really too much of a hassle for me. So we've started to see the companies that specialize in these huge supermarkets start trying to figure out smaller formats that will work for them. And I think part of that is wanting to have more of a relationship with a customer, as the questioner asked.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting, though, that at least initially, though, this was something that people really responded to, and I'm sure that it was in part because women, and they were the one that were doing they were the ones that were doing the shopping. They could actually spend less time shopping, and that would mean they could spend time doing other things because they only had to go to one store.
Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think part of what I've tried to evoke in my book is what the shopping experience was like in the 1920s and 1930s, when most people still didn't have cars, when most people still had little apartments in the city. And at that point in time, you had more than 500,000 grocery stores in the country. You had one grocery store for every 52 families in the United States. And so people walked to the grocery. They bought a very small number of things. And they did it every day. It was just part of their routine. But this was a burden. There's no question. And as it became possible to shop on a larger scale, it was hugely convenient for shoppers and especially for housewives to do that. So there's really no going back.
In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Mark Levinson. He is the author of the book The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger, and his new book, which is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. It's published by Hill and Wang. And indeed, it is a history of that company that at one time was known as the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and probably to a lot of people would just be better known as the A&P, which was one time one of the biggest companies in the United States. In 1925, they had $352 million in sales. Within a few years of that, the A&P was the world's biggest retailer. By 1929, they had almost 16,000 stores. This book sort of tells the story of how that happened, how the company developed, some of their innovations, its rise and its decline. And it's an interesting story. One other thing that I want to talk about, I want to have you talk about, because I think it's really important here, and then I want to make sure that we go on and talk about the political stuff as well. But what the impact was on, say, American families and what they had to be spending their money on, that we had this big chain that was, and I'm sure that probably some others tried to follow that model as well, that was really aggressively working to drive down the price of food. This was a big change in the time that we're talking about, say in the mid to late 30s, or mid to late 20s.
Oh, it certainly was. In that time period, the average urban working family spent more than a third of its income on food. I mean, food was a big expense because these mom-and-pop stores where people shopped were expensive. There was a long and inefficient distribution system, and all of those costs were paid for by the shopper. A&P's prices were consistently 10 to 15% below those at independent stores, and so it actually made it possible for average families to eat better. And the sort of management methods that A&P introduced have really contributed to remarkable decline in the relative cost of food. I mean, today the average family may spend 6, 7, 8% of its income on food as opposed to more than a third back then. And a lot of that reduction in cost is just due to the greater efficiency that A&P brought to bear.
All right, let's take some other callers here. We have several. We'll start in with line number 2. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm not sure you addressed this in your book, but having grown up on the East Coast, there was a lot of gossip going around about the family of A&P.
Right.
And a daughter. There was a story that this young girl had gotten pregnant in the family, had a backstreet abortion, and died because of it. And I just wondered, I've always heard this about A&P and wondered if that was a true story.
I don't know, to answer your question. There were, the company was controlled for many, many years by these two brothers, George and John Hartford, who between them worked there for 143 years.
Uh-huh.
And neither of these men had children.
Okay.
They had their own interesting lives. John got married at the age, George got married at the age of 42, and being a very reclusive and organized man, he lived in the same house for the rest of his life and wore the same clothes to work every day and arrived at the office at the same time every morning and did very regular. John got married to the same wife twice.
Oh, okay. Well, good. That's good to know then it was just a rumor that it wasn't true.
Well, there are some other rumors, okay? When they died in the 1950s, the shares were apportioned among their nieces and nephews. And their nieces and nephews, there were some colorful people in that group. One of them was Huntington Hartford, who became famous as a sort of playboy and art connoisseur, and he blew a lot of the family money on a museum in New York that nobody visited.
Okay.
And liked to hobnob with artists and that sort of thing. Another of the nephews, Josephine, was a great athlete and became very influential in environmental issues and things like that. So this family has been quite active in many things over the time, but it's all nieces and nephews and their descendants, because John and George Hartford themselves did not have children.
Then that must have been what it was. Well, it sounds very interesting. I'd love to read it.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, and we'll just keep going, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hello. You know, the other efficiency that came about, and I don't know if you mentioned that because I was trying to get on the air, having multiple stores in the same market, you have efficiency in terms of advertising and promotion.
Right.
Were they one that brought that concept to bear or not?
Well, actually, they learned that pretty early on. As was mentioned earlier, the Great Atlantic and Pacific started out mostly selling tea and then sold coffee and sugar in the 1800s. There weren't really any grocery chains at that point because you couldn't really sell groceries. There were not brand names. There were not there were not the sorts of things you could sell very profitably in the grocery store because most groceries came in bulk. And so the development of the grocery retailing business really had to wait for the invention of cheap cardboard boxes and a cheap canning process so that you could have packages you could put brand names on that could be sold in the store. Once that happened, which was really in the 1890s, then you started having other companies start to create grocery chains. And A&P tried to do it too, but it was at a disadvantage for exactly the reason you're pointing to. As a tea store, A&P had stores in a lot of cities, but they only needed to have one or two stores in each city because people didn't buy tea all that often. Tea wasn't all that heavy, so you could buy it downtown and take it home with you on the trolley car. Groceries weren't like that, so you needed to have a bunch of stores together so you could advertise, so you could have your own warehouse nearby to supply them. So A&P really had to change its strategy in the early part of the 1900s and start building more stores in individual cities so it had the kind of density that you're talking about. You're absolutely correct in terms of the economics of the business.
Now, the other point was interesting is that when you said they set up, two different stores, you know, that was with the tea to compete with the other, this is the main strategy that Procter & Gamble became such a giant, is where they would have their brands compete against each other and not, you know, advertise Procter & Gamble, whereas, you know, like Johnson & Johnson would, you know, advertise that. But did P&G pick up the concept from them?
I don't know the answer to that. At one point, George Gilman, the founder of A&P, he actually had four different tea companies. And they were all the same business, but they operated under four separate names with four separate addresses. And it was clearly, you could buy your tea from Consumers Tea Company, or you could buy your tea from the Great American Tea Company, or whatever. It was all the same tea, and it was all stored in the same building. But he seemed to feel this somehow was going to stimulate business.
Oh, good program. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to somebody here on a cell phone calling on our toll-free line, line 4. Right here. Hello.
Yes. My first comment would be what you've described and what exists today is, I think, by the theorists and other economic venues, is called imperialism. Because when the big ones eat the little ones are gone, and then they start on each other. And I think Kroger is still around, only they're diminishing, I think. That is my first comment. And my life experience, I grew up in a little place called Terre Haute, Indiana, and the A&P was rather large there and competed with Kroger. And it seems to me, if I remember right, A&P had a food factory where they manufactured canned goods and such as that. Do you have any knowledge about operations like that in other venues with A&P?
A&P was one of the largest food manufacturers in the country. Starting in the 1920s, they integrated vertically. They made They made their own bread. They were the second biggest baker in the country. They bought up a bunch of salmon canning factories after World War I. The industry in Alaska went bust. They were the second biggest salmon canner by the 1920s. They were the biggest coffee distributor. They built a warehouse in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and handled their own coffee. So they really integrated vertically. And as I tell the story in the book, it took them a while to figure out how to do this profitably, because having the factories was actually less profitable than having the stores. But they learned that if they organized the orders from the stores correctly, they could keep their factories going at full blast. And so they were operating then very efficiently. And then they figured out that once they had these factories, they could go to outside suppliers and they could bargain. They could say, we think that producing this can of baked beans takes about 3 cents. And if you'll do it, we'll buy it from you for 3 cents. And if you can't produce it for 3 cents, we're going to make it ourselves. People talk today about Walmart and its rather bare-knuckle tactics with suppliers forcing down prices. But A&P was doing this sort of thing in the 1920s. It was dealing really tough with suppliers. It offered them a lot of business, but it expected them to be very efficient and to keep their costs down.
And again, one has to say that values about small businesses and wanting to support them being all well and good, that this was something that consumers responded to hugely.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And for companies, for suppliers that did it well, I mean, A&P opened the door to a national market. If you could do business with A&P, then you could sell coast to coast, and they would order by the train car load. But they were very demanding. I found this wonderful letter in the archives from, I think it was called the Richmond Pickle Company, and it talked about how A&P returned 300 cases of pickles because A&P's laboratory had detected that there wasn't the right amount of caraway seed or something in the pickles, and that they'd been right, that somebody had been on vacation and they'd made the pickles improperly for a couple of weeks. And this was an example of the sort of quality control that the industry was not used to. And A&P went about this in a very systematic way.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I want to get at least one more caller in here. We'll go next to Savoy and line one. Hello.
Hi. I was going to talk about the tea connection. In the early part of the 20th century, I don't know how long it continued, there was a rural door-to-door type of business. I guess it was connected with the same company. It was called A&P.
Right.
And they sold tea and coffee and I think spices.
Right.
But one, and they came like every week.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a ready-made customer list, you know. And I don't know if this played into the clientele for the grocery stores, but one of their most distinctive products was the china or the pottery prizes or whatever they used to sell cheap if you bought so much.
Right.
And it is very distinctive. You can't miss even today in the antique markets. If you see an A&P piece of pottery, you immediately recognize it as A&P. I was wondering, could you purchase those at the grocery stores?
You couldn't purchase them. They were premiums.
Yeah. That's...
A&P uh-huh. Used what later became known as trading stamps.
That's right.
And so you would get, you'd be given little coupons initially.
Uh-huh.
And each coupon would be stamped by the store, and then you'd collect your coupons, and this was especially good for the housewife of the family, okay? Because she wanted something, and it involved spending cash, and she'd ask her husband, and the husband would say, "Well, I don't think we got the cash for that," you know. But this was sort of almost money; it was like money, and the housewife controlled it.
Yeah, and almost everybody ate off of A&P dishes.
Well,
know,
if the dishes are what
the
they wanted, but you could also buy clocks and musical instruments. I mean,
really,
they,
I didn't know that.
They had it started out with dishes, but it expanded and they had a catalog of all the different things you could buy. Eventually, they took it out of the stores because it was taking up too much space. And so they started publishing a catalog, and then you would send your coupons in by mail, and you would get your premium in return. So, yes, this was a big business, and it was a business that A&P developed and then developed along with after they got tired of running it themselves because it was too big, they brought in the company that became S&H Green Stamps, and they ran it for A&P.
I want to jump in here, Apthagolo, forgive me, because we have about 5-6 minutes left here. And there is one thing that at least I want to have you talk a little bit about. A little earlier, we talked about the fact that while consumers appreciated low prices, there were people in government, both at the state and federal level, who were very concerned with the impact of the chain stores, and A&P was probably the number one on their list, the impact of the store on small business people. And as you explained, there were a number of laws, regulations, taxes that were put into effect to try to blunt the power of the chain store. I do want to talk about the fact that there was eventually, specifically in regards to A&P, there was an antitrust suit.
Not only is there an antitrust suit, this is some local history.
That's why I want to make sure that we mention it. Yeah.
In 1944, the federal government, this was Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Franklin Roosevelt, who portrayed himself as the pro-consumer president, the first pro-consumer president, they filed an antitrust suit against A&P, charging it with selling groceries too cheaply, basically, monopolizing the grocery business to sell groceries too cheaply. They filed this antitrust suit in Dallas, Texas, and a judge in Dallas threw most of it out. So the government withdrew the case, and they brought it to Danville, Illinois, and they refiled it in Danville. There was a big trial in Danville, it's in the building that's now the Danville Post Office. The trial went on for months and involved tens of thousands of documents and a massive amount of evidence and information, and eventually John and George Hartford and other executives in their company were found guilty of criminal violations of antitrust law for selling groceries too cheaply. The judge found that the purpose of the antitrust law was to allow equality of opportunity. And by selling things too cheaply, A&P was not providing sufficient opportunity for other businessmen who wanted to be in the grocery trade.
Hmm.
And that decision was upheld by a U.S. Court of Appeals.
And somehow the idea that the low price was of a benefit to the individual, and if people were paying less of their money for food, somehow that didn't enter into the equation?
This whole decision is rather startling because you normally, thinking about antitrust policy, you ask, why is monopoly bad? Well, why monopoly is bad is that the monopolist is going to limit the supply and uses control to drive prices up. But here we've got a case in which the monopolist was accused of having control and using it to drive prices down, a very strange thing, which doesn't quite comport with our current ways of thinking.
Mm. Just at the beginning, I think we talked about the fact that for the company and for particularly that maybe the genius of the people that really shaped the company and ran it for such a long time, George and John Hartford, that their simple but genius idea was that if you had enough volume, you could have your per unit cost be pretty low, and
right.
if you sold enough, you made money. I'm sure that there were others. What previous caller mentioned, Kroger. I think Kroger is also has been around for a long time. There's Woolworth, which is a very old name in retailing. So were there other companies who took a look at what the A&P was doing and saying, well, we could do that?
Well, the key year here is 1962. Okay, at this point, A&P was already visibly in decline. But 1962 was the year that saw the creation of three brands, not three companies, but three brands. One of them called Target Stores, which was a new chain that was run by an existing store. Another called Kmart, similarly a new chain run by an existing store, and the third would become Walmart. So all of those were retailers that picked up on this discounting trend and took it in new directions. A&P was not really comfortable selling anything but food. They didn't know quite what to do with this, so they just kind of stood by and watched.
Well, here now we're just about at the point where we have to finish up, and you know what happened to we did at the beginning talk a little bit about what happened to A&P. Partly it was that these two brothers who had run the business for such a long time died. The people who came along and ran it were not much into new things, and then there were the nieces and the nephews that actually took the company public. Because they wanted to get some cash out of it, and they weren't really interested in selling groceries. So maybe it was a combination of a family business that passed into hands that weren't interested in running it, and also the world continued to change, and they simply just they didn't keep up.
No, the A&P story is in part a reminder that you really have to, if you're in business, you really do have to keep remaking your company, as uncomfortable as that is. People are comfortable with the old way of doing things, but at a certain time, the old way stops working, and the world changes pretty quickly, and you do have to change to stay with it.
Yeah. Well, it's really quite an interesting story, and as we talked about from the very beginning, it's a pretty good story, just if you look at the history of the company and the individuals that were involved, but that it does get at this much bigger issue, this big tension between the wanting to have things as cheaply as you can get them, but then we do have this impulse. We say, well, we like the idea of the mom-and-pop retailer, but it seems that it's pretty hard to do both those things at the same time.
This tension is still very much with us today.
Yeah. Mark Levinson is our guest. His book is The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. It is published by Hill and Wang. It's just recently out. You also might want to take a look at his other book, The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger. And Mr. Levinson, thank you very much.
David, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show on September 12th, and there are many past shows for you to listen to on our website. If you go there, it's WILL.illinois.edu. You can look at the schedule for upcoming shows and then listen to some you might have missed first time around. On the program on Monday in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with a man who is an award-winning wine professional, both as a writer and importer, a winner of the James Beard Award. His name is Terry Thies, and he has authored a book that came out last year that was very well received. The title of his book is Reading Between the Wines. And so we'll talk a little bit about wine and what the sources of pleasure in wine are and how it is. Maybe if you feel intimidated by the idea of wine, you can get around that. That'll be in the first hour on Monday. And then hour number two, we will look at the problem of access to civil justice. If people are in a criminal situation, they are guaranteed a lawyer. But if they have a civil problem, there is no such guarantee. And it can be very difficult for people of limited means to get legal help if they're have a civil issue to deal with. And we'll be talking on Monday with Rebecca Sandifer. She is a sociologist here at the University of Illinois and is the lead author of what is said to be the first national survey of civil justice legal services available in the United States. And she says it can be very, very variable. Your access to that kind of legal help varies a great deal depending on where you live. That's on Monday at 11. And again, you can check the schedule for the rest of the week by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713. WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn incorporates residents' past routines and interests into their daily lives, engaging residents in choices and daily living patterns. More information is available at 384-0100.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3.
Urbana. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 693 and three quarters, down 3 1/4. The March contract, 707 and a quarter, down 3 3/4. December wheat in Chicago, 613 and a half, down 6 1/2. March, 640, down 7. December corn, 638 and a half, down 7. March, 647 and a half, down 7 1/4. May, 654, down 7 3/4. July, 655 and three quarters, down 7 3/4. November soybeans, 1165 and three quarters, up 7 3/4. January, 1174, up 6 1/2. March, 1183 and three quarters, up 6 1/2. May, 1194, up 7. December meal, 297.80, down 10. December oil, 50.85, up 33. December live cattle, 121.05, down 55. February, 123.30. Down 35. November feeder cattle, 142.50, up 42 1/2. January, 145.67 1/2, unchanged. December lean hogs, 86.42 1/2, up 67 1/2. December crude oil, 98.57, that is up 79. The U.S. dollar, 76.88, down 87. The CRB